Case number 205944, Camissa Roland versus Southern Health Partners, Inc. et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Belsley, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Greg Belsley. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of the appellant, Camissa Roland. I would request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Fine.
Your Honors, my client spent 42 days in the Franklin County Jail suffering from untreated ulcerative colitis that manifested itself in nausea, vomiting, rectal bleeding, and abdominal pain. She stayed there until her emergent transport to a hospital, and by that time, the mat on which she lay was covered in vomit, feces, and urine. She received no treatment during that entire period of time for her obviously serious medical condition.
She received medication, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
But that's not treatment? That's not treatment?
No, Your Honor. Not in this case. The Sixth Circuit said in the Westlake case that treatment can be so cursory and ineffective as to amount to no treatment at all. And what Ms. Roland received while she was at the jail for her ulcerative colitis was two separate prescriptions at very different periods of time of prednisone. She got a prescription of prednisone on September 21, 2017, but that was only a prescription for 5 days. No follow-up was made as to whether it was effective and it was allowed to lapse.
Well, this case is tough because there's a number of different defendants, there's a number of different claims, there's a long 42-day history. So can I talk to you about Nurse Trivette specifically?
Yes, sir.
My understanding is that there were 7 slips in the record where your client complained of medical issues and that Nurse Trivette called on her each time within 24 hours. What is the claim against her that she was not just negligent, but met the really high standard of deliberate indifference in her treatment of your client?
And Your Honor, Judge Radler, you point to what we believe is the critical error in the district court's judgment. Judge Van Tatenhove said that every time Ms. Roland asked, she was seen by Nurse Trivette. Here's the problem, Your Honor. Nurse Trivette is a licensed practical nurse. And she admits that she has no power. In fact, it exceeds her scope of legal authority to diagnose or treat an illness. The record further reflects that Ms. Trivette did not implement the hospital doctor's orders after Ms. Roland returned to the jail on September 13, and that she be sent to a specialist. She did not implement the APRN's orders on October 16 that Ms. Roland be sent to a specialist.
Well, didn't she call a specialist? So your first point, I'm not sure how that's helpful, because maybe you're saying someone else in the facility should have stepped up, but the fact that this nurse couldn't do more doesn't seem to me to be incriminating to her in particular. Your second argument, they did call a specialist, correct? And they just couldn't get in as quickly as maybe someone would have liked, but they did call a specialist and it was like, it was going to take 6 months.
That's what Ms. Trivette said she did. There's no other confirmed corroborating evidence of that. Ms. Jensen said she expected that could be arranged within a week. And there was absolutely nothing about the order by Ms. Jensen that Ms. Roland be seen by a specialist that indicated it could wait indefinitely. Judge Rader, the importance of Nurse Trivette's inability to diagnose or treat is because when the district court said every time Ms. Roland asked to be seen, she was seen by Ms. Trivette, that seemed to equate being seen by someone who could neither diagnose nor treat with treatment.
She recommended that the doctor who come or the APRN who comes through once a week see your client.
Well, Your Honor, that brings up, that's another good point. Despite the fact that the APRNs they switched or they alternated weeks. They visit the jail once a week. There's not an APRN at the jail every day.
Right.
And they come in once a week. And what they do when they come there is they see inmates on a sick list that's put on that sick list by Ms. Trivette.
But she did.
APRNs.
Trivette put her on the list.
No, Your Honor. Nurse Trivette said that saw Ms. Rowland on October 4 and noted at that time, refer to APRN. Now, despite that, she didn't call the APRN, which she could have, and an APRN didn't see Ms. Rowland for almost 2 weeks.
There's an argument that one of the APRNs missed an appointment, correct? But it feels to me like Trivette basically did what she was supposed to do. She put the name forward. And I guess we have this Griffith case. You're probably familiar with it, right? Because it involves all the same people. I think maybe you're involved with it too.
My case, Judge.
So the only people who are new are the judges, I guess. But in that case, the facts seem awfully similar to this one.
No, Your Honor.
We said it could, we said it, you know, maybe this is a negligence or malpractice, but it certainly didn't meet the deliberate indifference standard to not, you know, not see an APRN right away or go to the hospital right away.
Judge Radler, this was a far more serious medical condition, and it was far more clearly manifested over time. And Ms. Rowland did not get even the attention Mr. Griffith got. The facts show that Ms. Rowland was basically surrendered to the attention of an LPN who could neither treat nor diagnose her illness, except on two occasions. The first one was when she was taken to the hospital on September 13, and the hospital's doctor ordered that she be taken to see a specialist and given prednisone. She was never taken to a specialist. That was ignored by the LPN, who had no power, and that was ignored by the APRN, who saw that order. Neither had the power to ignore that order. Then again, the only other time she's seen by somebody who can actually diagnose and treat her illness is on October 16. When APRN Jensen sees her then, she says, send this lady to a specialist. It still doesn't happen. And Ms. Rowland is still in the jail on October 25, receiving no treatment for her ulcerative colitis.
She got medication, right? She got medication.
When she got the second dose of prednisone, Your Honor, beginning on October 16, 2 days later, on October 18, Ms. Rowland filed a medical request saying, this isn't helping. I'm getting worse.
I don't want to hurt you. I'm sorry. I don't want to take all your time, but isn't there a thought that this medicine needs some time to kick in? It seems like medical, I guess I had 2 points. One, these seem sort of like medical judgments that we don't normally challenge. And two, I guess I thought your best argument, this is just me, I thought your best argument was as to the APRN who sort of missed the appointment. I think it was on the 10th.
She was there, but she didn't, despite seeing a chart and signing a chart that indicated that Ms. Trivette believed Ms. Rowland needed to be seen by an APRN, the APRN didn't see her.
Is that right? The APRN Bartram, is that who that is?
That's correct, Your Honor. Now, Your Honor, when you go to the question of second guessing medical judgments, I want to emphasize there's only two instances in which medical judgments were made in Ms. Rowland's case. That was by the hospital doctor on September 13, whose medical orders were then ignored, and by Ms. Jensen on October 16, whose order that she be transmitted to a specialist was ignored, and whose order for prednisone within 2 days had Ms. Rowland complaining that, number one, usually this works. Ms. Rowland said, usually when I get prednisone, it helps. But it's not helping and I'm getting worse. She actually said that in a lengthy 2-page medical request that she filed.
So that request on October 18th, that went to Trivette, the LPN, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, because she's the only one there to receive it.
Right, and so LPN Trivette is the one who failed at that point to undertake any further efforts on the part of Ms. Rowland.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Despite receiving this request and then seeing Ms. Rowland.
Because she saw her, so she didn't totally neglect her. She saw her.
But
she began that.
She saw, but Judge.
What can Trivette do? What are the powers of an LPN when a patient who has ulcerative colitis and has all of these facts that we'll not reiterate?
Your Honor, what an LPN...
medicine's not working. I'm in desperate shape with all sorts of details. What can Trivette do?
Your Honor, Ms. Trivette has testified. All she can do is take down the inmates' vital signs, take down their subjective complaints, make her own objective observations, and then call somebody like an APRN or a doctor and convey that information to them so that they can make a differential diagnosis and then prescribe treatment. But the only two times that was ever done for Ms. Rowland, the treatment ordered was not provided. So
you're talking about the 18th, and you're not stating on the 16th they provided her medication, and Trivette, I don't know if she saw her on the 16th, but then she then saw her on the 18th and 19th. I thought the testimony said they wanted to give the medicine time to work. She also had already contacted the specialist, but was not able to arrange an immediate appointment, and then saw her again on the 19th for a UTI, and she gave her medication for the UTI as well. I'm not saying it was perfect, but it feels like a long ways to me from deliberate indifference.
Judge, she's given prednisone on the 16th. On the 18th, she says, it's not working and I'm getting worse. It was a week after that before she was sent to the hospital. And again, I emphasize, whether Ms. Trivette...
The rule just can't be that when a medical professional makes a judgment, if the patient disagrees with it 2 days later, that's deliberate indifference.
Judge, it's an indication that the treatment is ineffective. And this court has said, the Sixth Circuit has said, repeated resort to ineffective treatment can amount to deliberate indifference. And that's what we have here. And again, Ms. Trivette has no power to make a judgment that this court can second guess. Your Honors, I see my time is up. If there are no further questions, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you. Ms. Brannon.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jane Brannon. I'm here on behalf of Southern Health Partners, Jane Bartram, Stacey Jensen, and Savannah Trivette. I have a lengthy prepared set of remarks, but I think based on some of the questioning, I may just jump straight to the issues that Judge Radler has raised with respect to Savannah Trivette. If I could make the point that after she was seen by Nurse Trivette on the 18th and 19th and was treated for the UTI, she submitted no further medical request slips, made no further complaints until the day that she was taken to the hospital with complaints of vomiting and worsening condition. So to the extent that there's the suggestion that between the 18th, 19th, and the 25th, that there was continual complaints, I think that Your Honor had probably put your finger on what is an issue. Prednisone does not take immediate effect. And as the plaintiff's own expert has testified, ulcerative colitis is intermittent vomiting, diarrhea, nausea, pain, and it can sometimes require multiple rounds of treatment before it responds to anything. So the idea that simply because 2 days after she was started on this second course of prednisone, she's not sure that she's improving, that's not an indication that she's not improving. And I would suggest to the court that the indication that she did improve was that she didn't submit any further requests between the 18th and the 25th with respect to her gastrointestinal issues.
Was she seen by anyone during that time frame from October 19th to the 25th? She was not getting medicine delivered to her.
No, she was continuing to take the prednisone. So on the 16th, Ms. Jensen entered an order for a 2-week course of prednisone. The original order was for 5 days. She responded somewhat when she went off of that, The symptoms recurred. So Ms. Jensen started her on another course of prednisone for 2 weeks.
And how does it work in the jail? Who gives her the prednisone each day?
Ms. Trivette or one of the other nurses would go on MedPass every day and provide that medication to her. So not only if you want to submit a medical request slip, that's the process, but she would have seen Nurse Trivette on those days. And if she was not improving, could have also made a complaint in that way or a request for treatment, but she did not. Her condition is one that is, it's not a good condition, and it is not something that responds necessarily very quickly. And I think that Ms. Rowland is very experienced with that, as she's testified. You know, she has had previous hospitalizations for her ulcerative colitis, despite having been treated on the outside. So with respect to the quote unquote orders from the ER doc, I would point out that the ER doctor did not provide orders or prescriptions. He provided aftercare instructions and a home medication list, which are his recommendations or his suggestions.
Counsel, Judge Rogers, are you referring to that doctor's form that he filled out, which says this person in capital letters should be seen by a specialist? I don't have the exact language. Is that what you're referring to now?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm referring
to the strongest argument for the other side. It pretty well. Now, you can say, well, that was just a recommendation or an observation. But somebody looking at that, as I looked at it, I don't have it in front of me right now, it looks like action is necessary promptly. Would you say that's wrong or right?
I agree that she needed to be seen promptly is probably as fair a word as possible. Now, what is
promptly in capital letters?
No, Your Honor, I think that what it said was she should be seen by her doctor, Dr. Shackleton. It didn't say take her any place as soon as possible. It didn't say it was emergent. And frankly, if the ER doctor thought that her situation was emergent, she was in the hospital. And if anyone's going to be able to get her seen immediately by a gastroenterologist, he's the one. Instead, he cleared her because she was not sent to the emergency room for her rectal bleeding, contrary to the assertion in the briefs. She was sent there because she'd been outside of the jail on a furlough and returned, and the jail staff x-rayed her and thought that she had contraband concealed in her rectum. She did also complain of some rectal bleeding. And when she got to the ER, she told the ER doctor, I have been having symptoms from my ulcerative colitis for the last month, which she had never reported to any of the medical staff at the jail. I've been having those symptoms for a month. I think I'm having a flare due to the prison food. And he says, you need to go see your doctor. And this is what I would suggest.
All right. Assuming that document, I don't know the nomenclature for these various medical referral documents, assuming that the nature of that document conveyed urgency with respect to having this condition be addressed, let's say, how should Nurse Trivette have responded? Or where was the ball dropped, because it didn't happen?
Your Honor, what happened is, with respect to those orders, the hospital had them on the 9th, the 13th of September. They did not fax them to the jail until the 19th of September.
When so Ms. on the Trivette 19th was, of December, they
got... I'm so sorry. I was saying the 19th of September, Your Honor. So they got them there, and Nurse Trivette did what she was supposed to do. She provided them to the APRN, who that very day, or no, 2 days later, entered the order for a 5-day course of prednisone consistent with the suggestions from the emergency room doctor. Whether or not the APRN should have entered an order directing that she be sent and be seen by an outside specialist is not anything that's within the record. And it's certainly not within Ms. Trivette's ability. She doesn't have the authority to provide medications without a prescription. And she does not have the ability to send someone to a doctor outside of the jail without the order from her own APRN. But significantly,
I just
so they, she needs an APRN to comply with, you can call them suggestions or recommendations or urgent imprecations from Dr. What's the name of the fellow who?
Dr. Stitch.
Dr. Stitch. So Dr. Stitch says, this person should be treating. This person should get examination or treatment, whatever it says in capital. And there's a lot of stuff in capital letters there. Mm-hmm. All right. Assuming that that's going to be complied with or at least taken into account, who should be doing that?
That would have been the role of the APRN, that those suggestions.
Which APRN?
That one was provided. Actually, both Nurse Bartram and Nurse Jensen both have seen those instructions. Now, they are both, Your Honor, independently licensed practitioners who can diagnose.
Disregard that?
Pardon me?
They can disregard that?
Absolutely. My doctor cannot call up a doctor at the hospital over at UK and say.
I don't mean legally disregard it. I'm talking about deliberately and differently disregarding it.
Well, it's an exercise of their medical judgment.
Say, well, they are legally allowed to have a second judgment, but sure. But if someone's dying, I guess they're legally allowed to decide not to treat them. But I'm giving an extreme example. But deliberate indifference is not the same thing as whether some doctor's recommendation is legally binding on you.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor. But with respect to Nurse Jensen or Nurse Bartram, or to analogize it to something here at our firm, if one of my partners suggests to me that it would be very advisable to do a certain thing, it's still my license, and I have the obligation to make the determination of whether or not that's appropriate.
Person advises you that the deadline for your megabuck case filing is tomorrow, and you better get on it.
Well, and maybe
then you can't come into court later and say I wasn't negligent because I didn't know how urgent it was.
But that's the key word right there, Your Honor. She may be negligent in the fact that she did not send Ms.
Yeah, but
Bartram.
You might be in that situation deliberately indifferent to the interests of your client. If you know that the case is going to be lost because you don't do something that you need to do in the next 3 days.
Well, but
that's your example. You know, just the fact that the lawyer, that the senior partner can't order you around doesn't mean that it's not deliberately indifferent to disregard the urgent message that your senior partner gave to you.
Can I ask a follow-up question? Because I think Judge Rogers is asking good questions, but I read the record a little bit differently. So this note that Judge Rogers is referring to says you should seek medical attention immediately if any of the following occurs, and then it has some different items which she may well have experienced. I thought she did receive. I thought she did seek medical attention. That she saw a nurse, like at least once a week, if not more. I thought, why isn't that seeking medical attention? I mean, this note could go to someone who's not in a facility where there's an on-duty medical attendant. So if I'm at home, there's no nurse in my house. Let's say I have to go to the hospital, but this person's in a facility where there is a medical professionals, and she saw them. Isn't, I mean, maybe you guys are talking about something different, but.
No, once upon a time, Judge Bertelsmann told me not to help him out, that he was doing just fine on his own with an argument. So I don't know that I can polish that argument any better than.
Well, I'm just wondering if we're talking about the same thing. Maybe you and Judge Rogers are talking about a specific incident, but I just thought she did seek treatment. And then the question would be whether that treatment was sufficient, I suppose.
So there are two parts to the note, as I understand it, from the instructions from the ER doc. One is the statement that it's very important for Roland to follow up with a gastroenterologist. And then another is you should seek medical attention immediately if various things happen. And that was as a result of the exam by Dr. Stitch on September 13th, when Roland was sent to the ER. So nothing happens to Roland until September 19th, is that correct?
I think that she was actually, the 19th is when the order was entered for her to begin receiving the 5-day course of prednisone, and it would have been provided to her that day.
I understand she did not receive the prednisone until September 21st, is that wrong?
I think that is correct, that the order was entered by Stacey Jensen, and the prednisone was provided on the 21st. I don't have anything in the record with respect to the cause of the delay, but I do know that the jails don't stock medications like that necessarily.
Well, prednisone is a pretty common thing, and it's very cheap. So it went from September 13th to September 21st without the ER doc's order that she get put on a 5-day course of prednisone. Is that correct? And usually ER docs don't give you the medicines themselves, right? You have to go to your pharmacy and pick it up. And of course, Ms. Rowland is not able to go to her pharmacy because she's in jail.
Although ER docs do provide prescriptions, and those are routinely sent back to the jail with people when they're discharged, I would point to out to the judge that no, the order, the aftercare instructions, which again are not orders, he can't order anything within the jail, but anyway, they were not sent to the jail until the 19th. That right, was 60 nothing.
Days later, right? So they got the instructions on the 19th, and they gave the medication on the 21st. Just to clarify the issue you're discussing, Judge Moore.
That's correct. So she did receive it within 48 hours of when the instructions were received and reviewed by the APRN.
And then Jensen was the one who was involved there, and she did not refer Rowland to a gastroenterologist specialist, right?
Not at that time.
When was the referral made?
She entered her order on the 16th of October that an appointment should be made with the UK gastroenterology department.
So that went from September 21st to October 16th before an order was made to somebody to make an appointment. Is that right? That's
correct. But Ms. Rowland had been on a 5-day course of prednisone by that point. Her condition had improved. She went off of the prednisone. The flare recurred, and she put in a request for to be seen, and she was seen by Nurse Trivette, who put her on the list to be seen by the APRN. Nurse Jensen did not determine to send her out until the 16th, at which time Nurse Trivette contacted UK and began the process of trying to set up an appointment for an inmate.
She was never actually given an appointment with the gastroenterologist until she was sent again to the ER with her acute symptoms. Was that right?
That is correct. She did not get to see a gastroenterologist between the recurrence of her flare and the 25th.
Nor did she have an appointment to see a gastroenterologist. Is that
correct? An appointment, nor had an appointment been arranged at that point. No, ma'am.
I was asking, before you're finished, I thought the weakest part of your case was as to APRN Bartram, who I think had a request from Trivette that she see Rowland. I think it's a she. And then she didn't see Rowland and didn't seem to have an explanation for that. And it was another week then before the other APRN, Jensen, I guess, saw her.
That is correct, Your Honor. The best I can do with that is the oversight or the lack of seeing her by Nurse Bartram, once again, does not rise to the level of criminal recklessness. And in addition, there's been absolutely no showing that there is anything that resulted as an injury to the plaintiff from any of the actions or inactions of any of the SHP defendants.
Absent any further questions, we thank you for your argument.
All right, thank you all very much.
Mr. Belsley.
May it please the court. First, let me address the issue of these complaints by Ms. Rowland. Ms. Rowland testified that she submitted far more complaints in writing to SHP that have been produced in this case. So there's a genuine dispute of fact on that. Moreover, as we've argued, Your Honors, Ms. Rowland shouldn't have had to submit any complaints. As soon as they determined that she suffered from chronic ulcerative colitis, Southern Health Partners policies and procedures require that she be monitored and that she be monitored for improvement or deterioration in her condition, particularly when, after she came back from the hospital, she was put in administrative segregation. Southern Health Partners, and by that I mean a cell all by herself, where other cellmates could not witness her condition. Southern Health.
You mentioned Southern Health Partners policies. Are the policies in the record?
Yes, Your Honor, they are. They were conventionally filed in the district court below. And in my reply brief, Your Honor, I gave you, because the district court does not file stamp conventionally filed documents, I provided Your Honor the page number and the bait stamp number of the policies where you can find the policies and protocols we're referring to.
Okay, we had some trouble finding the policies. So I would request that the two counsel get together and provide the court with the record document that was provided to the district court. So I'm not asking for anything outside the record, but with the SHIP policy provisions that are pertinent to this case, just because when we contacted the district court, they didn't appear to have this available. And so it would be helpful to us, given your statement that it is in the record, for us to have what was in the record.
We will do that, Your Honor. The only question I have is the reason they were conventionally filed was because Southern Health Partners says that they're proprietary and confidential, and a protective order was entered to that effect.
Well, we certainly can be preservative of any confidentiality. We as officers of the court, we will maintain appropriate confidentiality.
All right, Your Honor.
Either in the record or it isn't, though, right?
Exactly.
Well, there is a notation on the docket sheet that those documents were filed. And we make reference to that record number of the conventional filing in our brief.
Well, once again, I have no idea, but it's either there or it's not. We're not in one of these worlds where it might be one or the other. Could I ask a question about jurisdiction? Because I was puzzled, and maybe my colleagues can help as well. Actually, Judge Van Tatenhove ruled in your favor on a couple of issues, didn't he, Judge Belsley? Let the case go forward with respect to the negligent claim against two of these defendants?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then normally you couldn't appeal the summary judgment against the other people until you've run through the whole trial with respect to those people that he permitted to go forward. But instead, you went through a procedure. I'm just not familiar with the procedure where you just sort of dismiss those claims without prejudice, wait to see how these things turn out, where he's dismissed them, and then what, sue again because it's without prejudice? Is that the process? Is that what you have in mind? Is that you're going to go ahead and sue those people regardless of whether you win or lose here, but you really want to find out whether you win or lose here before you go and litigate those claims? Is that what you're trying to do?
Your Honor, what Judge Van Tatenhove dismissed our federal claims and then dismissed certain of our state claims without prejudice to their being refiled in state court. Under Kentucky law, we're permitted to appeal the dismissal of the federal claims and the dismissal of the state claims without prejudice. Typically,
you're saying that what he did was what? Well, he said that he was going to decline supplemental jurisdiction over those claims?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so they couldn't come back to the federal court then.
Well, typically they are reinstated if this court,
I don't see how they could be reinstated because that looks like a circumvention of the limits on interlocutory appeal.
Well, what I've done in the past, Your Honor, and this is a discussion that I've not had, but what I've done in the past is where the court has dismissed my federal claims with prejudice, but dismissed my state claims without prejudice, I have appealed both rulings.
You can, sure.
And as we have in this case, and then if the court, and I've also briefed included in my brief, a request that the court reverse the decision on dismissal without prejudice on the state
claims. So it wasn't, you didn't voluntarily dismiss those claims.
No.
You wouldn't appeal something that you volunteered to do, right?
No. No.
So what?
I did not surrender those claims. No, Your Honor. The reason.
What did you advise the district court? Because I got the impression that you voluntarily dismissed those claims if that could be done without prejudice.
Well, the court agreed to dismiss those claims without prejudice.
You say agreed. Who'd they agree with?
I believe that was a joint request by defendants and plaintiffs.
So you asked for these to be dismissed without prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why isn't that a circumvention of the limits on, for instance, if you said, I just want to have those stay while I litigate these other things, that normally wouldn't work unless there was a Rule 54 determination by the district court that the cases were sufficiently distinct and so forth. But you didn't go through that. You just sort of took the power to ask that these cases be dismissed without prejudice.
The state claims.
So you say that's appealable, but it wouldn't be appealable by you because you asked for it.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that restricts my right to appeal. The court, I
you
have
can
not
go to the court. I guess technically you can appeal something that you asked for, but you probably ought to lose when you ask for something and then you get it and you appeal from it.
Well, the reason it was done by Judge Van Tatenhove, Your Honor, is a recognition that it assists in the efficiency and judicial economy.
Well, then he should have entered a Rule 54 order, which provides for that.
Well, Judge Van
Tatenhove, this is not that, and he didn't do that, and he's supposed to do that if that's what he's doing, it seems to me. But maybe I'm missing something. What do you think, Judge Moore? I mean, I'm at.
Well, the one question that I have that relates to that is, if the district judge had dismissed the state claims because under the theory of supplemental jurisdiction, given that the district judge was rejecting your federal claims, then normally if you appeal on the federal claims and we reverse, then you would be able to revive the dismissed state claims because there would be federal question jurisdiction and the district judge might want to reconsider the dismissal. But I didn't see anything in the background materials here that suggested that was the reason why the district judge here dismissed the state claims. I didn't see it was because of the supplemental jurisdiction statute, but rather it was some joint motion between the two parties to dismiss the state claims. Am I right?
That's correct, Your Honor, because.
And what was the explicit basis when you two together moved for the district judge to dismiss the state negligence claims?
The thinking, Your Honor, was if this court reversed the federal claims, and then, like you said, the state claims would be reinstated.
Is that in writing anywhere?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. But that's almost done as a matter of course in cases that I've appealed, where the court has dismissed the state claims without prejudice. Once if it goes back, the court automatically reinstates it. And we didn't want to try a case on state claims and then have to come up to Your Honor with an appeal of the dismissal of the federal claims and perhaps go back and try those all again. So it was motivated by a sense of economy for both the court and the parties. Also, Kentucky law says that so long as, and this is an issue of Kentucky law, Kentucky law says, so long as I appeal the dismissal of state claims without prejudice, I toll my right to refile in state court until this court makes its ruling. So it's a.
Did you in this appeal raise as one of the issues that the district court improperly dismissed the state claims that it found there to be sufficient evidence?
I didn't argue that it was improper, Judge. I simply said that if the federal
challenge it and say it should be reversed.
I did. I said if the federal claims are reversed, we believe that the state claims should be revived and returned to Judge Van Tatenhove as well.
I see.
I'm well over my time. So
yeah, we've raised this as a new issue in your rebuttal. And so I want to give Ms. Brannon a chance if she has any like 2 minutes of thoughts on this issue that we have raised in rebuttal about the propriety of this dismissal without prejudice of the state claims and where they are on this appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I was trying to recall the conversation, the hearing with Judge Van Tatenhove. He had us come for a status conference because he was going to set the state law claims for trial. It was my recollection. And Mr. Belsley raised this issue of judicial economy and efficiency and requested that it be sent back to the state court. I know that I didn't object. I don't know that I joined in, but I don't, but that's not anything that was written down. And Mr. Belsley has made some of these arguments before. I just want to make clear, I don't agree with his interpretation of the tolling of the statute of limitations with respect to the state law claims just by the filing of this appeal, but that's something that we have as an issue in some other cases and not this one, or at least not this one yet.
So this is possibly taking us outside the record, but what is the statute of limitations for negligence claims in Kentucky?
1 year, Your Honor.
1 year.
And because both Judge Rogers and I have been raising questions about this, if either side would like to file a supplemental brief on this topic of what and maybe we judges should figure out a formulation, but I'm thinking that we should ask for supplemental briefs on the question of what to do vis-a-vis the dismissal without prejudice of the state negligence claims, and thinking of letter briefs simultaneous within 10 days from each side on that topic. But the three judges will get together in conference and firm up exactly what we're thinking of.
All right, Your Honor.
Letting you know what I'm thinking of with the understanding that it has to be the panel that decides.
I can express my concern is that arguably, but maybe not, it's a circumvention of Rule 54.
Yeah, 54B certification would be the normal rule that most of the time we would expect when a district court thinks that an appeal is warranted for part of the case, but not for all of the case, and all of the case has not yet been decided. But there hasn't been a 54B certification here, so that's somewhat academic. But given that we have spent a lot of time on this, we appreciate the thoughts that both of you have on this topic, and we will get an order out as to what exactly we want on letter briefs. And we thank you both for your argument.
Thank you very much. Your Honor.